One of the guests at the equestrian centre didn't hold back and caught this poor old bugger under the hoof. He shook his head disapprovingly. I'll tell you what, Mrs. Ballantyne. They don't give them even the basic rules to follow before they send them out. They just take the money and push them out the gate. Don't even care if they can ride half the time. Her grandmother nodded, her gaze still fixed on the dog. You're quite right, Niall. You're quite right. It's been a lot worse since they turned it into a hotel. At least before it was mainly locals. Now it's all your holiday makers, businessmen and the like, and all they care about is going out for a day's hunting. You can't tell them nothing. Old John McCrae at the yard there tells me you'd weep if you'd see the state some of the horses are brought back in. Her grandmother stared at him. Lame, are they? Lame would be the best of it. Some of them keep them going for 4, 6 hours, till they're practically broken-winded. He had one bleeding at the nose the other day, and that little chestnut mare they brought back from Tipperary. You remember the one? Scarred all down here, he pointed at his own side, because the stupid woman took it upon herself to wear spurs and put them on the wrong way up. Sabine watched as her grandmother winced in sympathy. It was an expression she had never seen before. I think I'll have a word with Mitchell Kilhoon, she said firmly. I'll tell him he has to look after his animals better, or we won't let them out with the hunt. You'll have a word with the master. I certainly will, she said. That'd be grand, Mrs. Ballantyne. It breaks my heart to see good animals injured for nothing. He gazed over at the hound, who was licking its good paw in misplaced sympathy. Poor old bugger could have been shot. Sabine, who had been gazing absently at the dog, looked sharply up at him. Shot? Niall looked briefly at her grandmother, then back at Sabine. Yes, miss. Would have been the kindest thing for him.
To be shot? How'd you work that out?
Niall frowned slightly. Well, a hound with 3 legs isn't no good to anyone, is it? It'd get left behind. Maybe even bullied. No kindness in that now, is there?
You would really have shot him? Sabine stared at her grandmother.
Niall's right, Sabine. An injured hound has no life.
Well, he has no life if you shoot him.
In rage, Sabine felt inexplicably tearful.
How can you be so cruel? How would you like it if I shot Bertie just because he couldn't do his job any more? Don't you have any sense of responsibility?
Her grandmother took a deep breath. She exchanged a glance with Niall, then moved as if to steer Sabine back towards the big house. They're not pets, dear. They're not like Bertie and Bella. They are hinds, specially bred. She was interrupted by the grinding roar of the Land Rover as it swerved into the yard, closely followed by a battered pale blue trailer. The clattering sound of its approach was met by a cacophony of noise from 2 of the kennels. Then the hounds swarmed out into the pens, throwing themselves against the wire in an ecstasy of barking and whining, tumbling on top of each other in an effort to get closer to the outside. Amidst the noise, the driver's door of the Land Rover opened, and Liam jumped lightly out. "Sorry I took so long, Niall. Wasn't no one there to load the bloody thing?" Oh, sorry, Mrs. Ballantyne, I didn't see yous there. Come on, Sabine, said her grandmother, steering her firmly towards the gate. Let's go back to the house. But Sabine resisted.
What's going to happen to the dog with the paw? Horatio? Is he going to be shot?
Her grandmother glanced briefly at the trailer, the back of which Michael had begun to lower, and began to push gently at the small of Sabine's back. No. He won't be shot. As Niall told us, the vet says he's getting better.
But why don't you treat him like the other dogs?
Niall took the other side of the ramp, and between them he and Michael lowered it to the ground, letting it drop the last 6 inches, with a resounding clang that set the dogs baying even more furiously. They looked, Sabine noted privately, a little scary. Sabine, come on! We really must get on. Her grandmother was tugging at her now. Sabine stood firmly, staring at her in some amazement.
was the urgency? What was it she didn't want her to see?
A stiff, dark brown leg answered her question. It swung down like an errant clock hand and stuck out rigidly from the back of the trailer at an improbable angle, pointing upward towards the chimneys. On the end of it was a black hoof, still shiny with some kind of decorative unguent. As Sabine watched, Niall looped a rope around it casually and pulled, while Michael, who had run lightly up the ramp, grunted out of sight in his efforts to propel the thing down.
"What are they doing?" she whispered.
She was too shocked to speak properly. "It's dead, Sabine." Her grandmother's weary tone suggested this had been expected. "It can't feel a thing."
Sabine turned to her grandmother, her eyes filled with tears.
Behind her, the dogs threw themselves frenziedly against the wire.
"But what are they doing?"
Sabine's grandmother gazed at the corpse of the bay horse, which was sliding inch by inch down the ramp. "It's going to the flesh house."
"The flesh house? The flesh house?"
"The hinds have to eat something, dear." Sabine's eyes grew wide. She stared at the dead horse, then at the slavering hounds behind her. All she could see was teeth and gums and spittle.
"They'll rip it to shreds!"
Her voice choked, and both palms flew unconsciously to her face.
"Oh, my God! I can't believe you're just going to let them rip it to shreds! Oh, God!"
The two men paused, then resumed their pulling as Sabine bolted through the gate and ran back towards the house. Mrs. H. had made the cup of tea some half an hour ago, but by the time Joy Ballantyne remembered to pick up the mug from the edge of the arga, a skin had formed on it, so that a pale brown sun sat in the middle of the surface of the liquid. She should have known it would be a bad idea to take Sabine to the kennels. They were a mucky business at the best of times, and the girl was still covered with the cellophane sheen of the city. City dwellers found it hard to confront the brutal business of life and death up close, and the city was shot through Sabine like a stick of rock. And Joy had quite enough to deal with as it was, what with Edward becoming so much worse. She lifted her head unconsciously, like a hound trying to detect any sound of movement from the upper floors. But Mrs. H. was out shopping, and the house lay in silence. The only sounds the distant clanking of the hot water system, and the occasional snore and fart of the two dogs who lay at her feet. Joy sighed. She had pondered long and hard on what to do with this girl. How to tease some enthusiasm, some life out of that tense, watchful little face. But she didn't seem to want to do anything. Just kept shutting herself away in her room, or trying to make herself disappear in different parts of the house. Her dissatisfaction at being with Kilcarrion, emanating from her like an unpleasant smell. She seemed uncomfortable anywhere. In her room, at supper, if touched by someone when she hadn't been expecting it, even in her own skin. Had Kate been like this? Perhaps she had. Joy, sipping at her lukewarm tea in the empty kitchen, flicked through memories like someone trying to locate a page in a book. Kate's adolescent sulks. Her fury at her parents' inability to understand her own preoccupations. Her later determination not to ride, so that the bay horse they had spent months finding for her had stood unridden in the bottom field, a permanent physical reminder of the abyss that lay between them. She was so different from her older brother, Christopher, who spent every weekend away from Dublin, point-to-pointing with his horses. It was hard to believe they were of the same blood. But here it was again in the shape of Kate's daughter. She had thought this might be rather fun, Joy conceded sadly as she finished her tea. She had wanted to like Sabine. She had wanted to give her a really fun stay here, full of fresh air and activity and good food, sent her back with a glow in those pale cheeks, and had spent hours trying to track down a nice little horse that could be her companion. Most of all, she had wanted the chance to behave as if she had a granddaughter, instead of trying to shut out the thought of her, as she had had to since she and Kate had properly fallen out. When Kate had telephoned out of the blue and asked if she could send her over to stay, she had mistaken Joy's silence for reticence and immediately, touchily, withdrawn her request. But Joy's silence had simply been a reaction of stunned pleasure. Never in the past 10 years had she imagined she'd have the chance simply to have her granddaughter around. Now the only times they were both comfortable were when Sabine disappeared over to Annie's house, which she did with increasing frequency. Sabine didn't even seem to like her grandmother, and Joy had to admit that she found the girl's company made her uncomfortable, even irritable. "Perhaps we're just too old for her," she thought, noting the creaking in her knees as she bent to stroke Bella's soft head. "We're too old and too boring, and she's used to a city life, the kind of life we couldn't hope to understand." Computers, that was what she wanted, wasn't it? Computers and television. Foolish to think she'd just fit in with us. Foolish to get cross with her just because she doesn't understand the Duke. Hadn't yet had to exercise any real responsibility. "And I should be sorry for her, not frustrated by her," Joy thought. What a rotten, disjointed little life she's had so far. She can't help who she is. That was down to Kate. "Come on, chaps," she said, straightening. "Let's go and find Sabine, shall we?" Joy's severe exterior contradicted a certain generosity of spirit. Although set in her ways, she was not so rigid that she couldn't flex a little when she was wrong. There were things she could do to make the girl happier, she was sure. Give her a few pounds and ask Annie if she would take her to the cinema. It would do Annie good to get out. She could see if Tom would teach her to drive the Land Rover around the bottom fields. She'd like that. Try to find some common ground. Joy told the dogs to stay and made her way up the stairs. When she had come up earlier to bring Edward some fresh water, she had heard sobbing from the blue room. Exasperated and unsure whether any approach would be rebuffed, she had made her way softly back downstairs. She remembered that now with some sense of shame. "For goodness sake, woman," she scolded herself. "She's just a child. You're the one who should be grown up enough to approach her." She stood outside the door, listening for sounds of movement, then knocked softly. Twice. There was no answer. Joy knocked again, then pushed open the door slowly. The bed, although bearing the imprint of a recent inhabitant, was empty. She glanced around and then, feeling somehow conscious of invading Sabine's privacy, she withdrew. She was probably at Annie's. Joy bit back sadness at the thought that her own granddaughter found it easier to sit in a house full of strangers than with her closest family. "It's not her fault," she told herself. "We just haven't tried hard enough to understand her." She closed the door quietly behind her, as if Sabine were somehow present, and had gone just a few steps down the hall when the door of the study caught her eye. It was ajar. Joy, irritated, was about to shut it when some instinct told her to look inside. She opened the door and walked in. It was a room she rarely entered. Edward had given up using it several years ago, and Mrs. H. was under his instructions to leave it alone, so it was easy to recognize that things had been disturbed. It would have been easy even if it hadn't been for the two boxes on the floor and the open photograph album propped against one of the rolled rugs. Joy stared at the photographs strewn across the floor. There was one of herself and Stella laughing at some joke. On Coronation Day. There was the junk that they had borrowed on Sundays to visit the beach at Shek O. There was Edward in his naval whites. And there was Kate as a young girl, with her little friend. Her little Chinese friend. Joy felt a welling of fury at the sight of her personal memories strewn carelessly across the rug, as if they were of little significance. How dare she? How dare she go through these personal things without even asking? She had a sudden sense of her granddaughter as an intruder, as someone ferreting around surreptitiously in her past. Those photographs were personal. They were her life, her memories, her private reminders of years past. And then just to leave them scattered carelessly, as if they were of so little consequence. Choking back a little sob of indignation, Joy stooped and began to throw the loose photographs back into the box, then replaced its lid unnecessarily firmly. She strode to the door and marched swiftly down the stairs, so that the dogs, rather than waiting eagerly, fled at her approach. It was the third time Sabine had seen Breakfast at Tiffany's. She knew this bit, where the party woman's hat got set alight and no one noticed. She knew this other bit, where Audrey Hepburn fell asleep in George Peppard's bed. He never tried to do anything to her, not like he would have in real life. And as for the bit where she made him look up his book in the library, well, Sabine could practically recite it off by heart. But it didn't matter, because she was much more interested in Annie. For a woman who seemed to do little other than sit in front of films all day, Annie had subscriptions to all the cable channels, as well as video shops within a 25-mile radius, she rarely seemed actually to watch any of them. Since Sabine had been there, which was almost the whole first hour of Breakfast at Tiffany's, she had flicked through two magazines, made marks against a few items of clothing in a thick catalogue, walked over to look out of the window at least twice, and frequently absented herself altogether, staring past the screen into the middle distance. It had got to the point where it was more compelling for Sabine to stop watching the film and watch Annie. But then, Annie never seemed able to concentrate on anything much. In conversations, as they leant conspiratorially together over a cup of tea, she would lose the thread of whatever they were talking about, so that Sabine would have to remind her. Or her face would go all blank, and occasionally she would disappear upstairs for 5 or 10 minutes. Frequently she would drop off to sleep, as if staying in the present were simply too exhausting. At first Sabine had found it unnerving, and had wondered whether she was doing something wrong. But then she saw that Annie did it with everyone, with Patrick, with her mother, even with Tom, and she decided it was just Annie's way. As Tom said, everyone had their ways, and provided there was nothing personal, you should just accept them. So where were you at this morning, Sabine? Annie, her feet tucked under her on the big blue sofa, turned away from the television screen. She was wearing a huge fisherman's jumper that seemed to swallow her up. Patrick's, probably. Did you go riding? Sabine nodded. She found she had unconsciously mimicked Annie's pose on the opposite sofa, and her bottom leg was getting pins and needles. Did Tom take you? Yes, she straightened her leg, observing her socked foot. Have you ever seen the hounds?
Have I seen the hounds? Of course I have.
You'll see them up and down this road often enough in the hunting season.
I mean where they live.
Annie looked at her inquiringly.
The kennels?
Sure. Grisly place, isn't it? Why? Did you get a bit of a shock? Sabine nodded again. She didn't want to tell Annie the whole story. Annie's home was where she got to pretend that life was normal, with television and gossip, and no mad old people, stupid rules and dead things. Annie noted Sabine's expression, then swung her legs round and planted her feet on the floor. He shouldn't have taken you. It's not a nice place if you're not used to livestock. It wasn't Tom.
Do all dead horses go there?
It's not just horses. You get cows, sheep, all sorts. They've got to go somewhere. I wouldn't get upset about it. Now, I'm going to put the kettle on. Do you want a cup? But of course it took Annie some 15 minutes to ask Patrick if he wanted tea. By the time she returned to the living room, Audrey Hepburn had got together with George Peppard and found her missing cat, and Sabine had decided she might have overreacted at the kennels. The animals were dead, as Annie said, and dogs had to eat something. It had just been a bit of a shock to see the rawness of it all, especially for a vegetarian. In London, her mother was careful to respect her views on eating meat, making sure that there was always cheese, pasta sauce and tofu in the fridge. And Jeff had often cooked vegetarian for all of them. It made it easier, he said. And it was probably good for them not to eat too much animal fat, because it was hard enough trying to keep hold of your beliefs without everyone treating them as if they were some bit of adolescent nonsense. Here, people kept forgetting that she didn't eat meat and serving it up anyway, or acting as if it were some bizarre foible that she was sure to grow out of. But then, there was no life and death at home, unless you counted what you saw on television. Here, it seemed to be everywhere. In the small animals that Bertie worried in the yard, in the horribly named flesh house at the kennels, in her grandfather's creased and craggy face, which no longer had the energy even to distinguish its various expressions. "Is my grandfather going to die?" she asked. Annie stood in the entrance to the kitchen, then thrust both hands awkwardly down the hem of her jumper. "He's not well," she conceded.
"Why won't anyone give me a straight answer? I know he's ill, and I can't ask my grandmother. I just want to know if he's going to die."
Annie poured the tea into stripy mugs. She was silent for a bit, and then she turned to Sabine.
"What difference does it make?" she asked. "It doesn't make any difference. I just want people to be honest with me."
"Honesty? Pah! You can have too much honesty, believe me."
Uncomfortably, Sabine recognised a faint note of aggression in Annie's tone.
"If it doesn't make any difference, then it doesn't matter. You should just appreciate him while he's here. Love him, even." Sabine's eyes widened at this. The idea that love was something one could inflict on that crotchety old man seemed faintly ridiculous.
He's not really a very loving type person," she ventured slowly.
"Why? Because he's old and difficult? Or because you find him uncomfortable to be around?"
Sabine felt increasingly uneasy at the tone of Annie's voice. Annie had been one of the few people she felt understood her, and now she was acting like Sabine had somehow said something wrong. "I didn't mean to offend you," she said sulkily.
Annie placed a mug of tea in front of her. When Sabine looked up again, she was gazing at her, and her eyes were kind. "You didn't offend me, Sabine. I just think it's important to love people while you have them. However long you have them."
Here her eyes filled with tears, and she looked away. She had done it again. Sabine felt herself chill, conscious that she had somehow again made Annie cry. Why couldn't she get the measure of any of these people? Why did she always feel as if she was misreading some crucial signal, like she did when she was hanging around with a crowd she didn't know at home and couldn't get any of their sayings and in-jokes? "I do try to be nice to everyone," she ventured quietly, desperate to have Annie think well of her again.
Annie sniffed and wiped her nose with the back of her sleeve. "I'm sure you do, Sabine. You hardly know them, is all.
It's just they're not easy people to show feelings to. They're not very, well, feelingy, if you know what I mean."
Annie laughed and placed her hand on Sabine's. It was cool and soft and dry. Sabine's own were hot with discomfort. "You're not wrong there. Getting those two to show their feelings, well, you'd probably have more luck asking the Duke." They both laughed companionably into the silence. Sabine felt herself relax. They must have passed through whatever invisible turbulence she had blundered into. "But seriously, Sabine, I mean it. Just because they're not easy with showing it doesn't mean they don't feel it. They were interrupted by a sharp rapping on the door. With a quick, quizzical glance at Sabine, Mrs. H and Tom always let themselves in, Annie got out of her chair and walked to the door, pushing her hair behind her ears. Sabine started to see Joy standing there, tall and rigid in her headscarf, her face taut and her arms, padded in their quilted jacket, fixed awkwardly to her sides.
"I'm so sorry to trouble you, Annie. I was wondering whether I could talk to Sabine."
"Of course, Mrs. Ballantyne." Annie stepped backwards, pulling the door further open. "Come right on in."
"No, I won't come in, thank you very much. Sabine, I'd like you to come home."
Sabine stared at Joy, noting the barely repressed fury emanating from her grandmother. Quickly she ran through a checklist of possible misdemeanors. No, the shampoo bottles were in her room. Her boots were clean. Her bedroom door was shut to stop Bertie getting in. Yet something in Joy's face made her distinctly unwilling to leave the comfort and safety of Annie's house. She stared at Joy, trying hard to quell her growing sense of unease.
"I was just having a cup of tea," she said. "I'll come along after."
Joy flinched slightly. Something in her eyes turned hard and steely.
"Sabine," she said, "I'd like you to come home now."
Sabine's heart was thumping.
"No," she said, "I'm having my tea."
Annie's eyes flickered between the two visitors. "Sabine," she said, and her voice held a warning.
"I'm sure it can't be that urgent," said Sabine defiantly.
She knew she was in uncharted territory now, but something in her rebelled against being marched home to that miserable house, to be railed against for some minor domestic misdemeanor. Sabine had had enough.
"I'll come when I'm ready," she said.
Something in Joy appeared to erupt. She marched past Annie into the room, carrying the chill air of outside around her like a radioactive buzz.
"How dare you," she breathed. "How dare you go through my private things? How dare you start ransacking my private photographs without even thinking to ask me? Those were private, you understand? They were not meant for you to look at."
With a start, Sabine remembered the photographs, her face pinking with discovery. She had not even thought of putting them away. It seemed unnecessary, as no one ever went into the room. But any guilt was overshadowed by the scale of her grandmother's response. She had never seen her lose her temper before. Her voice crackled like a dry log in a fire, and her hair seemed suddenly electrified, springing free from its two clips. But as the tirade continued into the charged atmosphere, the adrenaline infected her, and Sabine found herself shouting in response.
"They're only photographs," she yelled over her grandmother's voice. "All I did was look through a box of bloody photographs. I was hardly going through your underwear drawer, was I?"
"They were not yours to go through. You had no right."
Joy's voice lifted on the last word, making her sound curiously adolescent.
"Right, right."
Sabine stood up, pushing her chair back behind her with a shuddering bump.
"I've not had a single bloody right since I came here. There's bloody nothing I can do without your permission, is there? I can't walk around the house. I can't talk to the staff. I can't even have a bloody bath without worrying whether someone's going to come in and stick a ruler in to see whether I'm using too much water."
"Those were my personal things," Joy shouted. "How would you like it if I went through your personal things?"
"You know what? Why don't you go and have a look? Because I haven't got any personal things, have I? I don't get to keep my personal bloody toothbrush in the bathroom. I don't get to watch the programmes I want. I can't even use the telephone to make a personal call."
Here Sabine's voice began to break, and she thrust her fists into her eyes, determined not to let the older woman see her cry.
"Sabine, you could do anything you wanted, but not if you just skulk around the place refusing to join in. You have to join in."
"With what? Hunting? Feeding dead horses to the dogs? Sorry, hounds. Help the 8 million people a day who faff around preparing my grandfather's boiled eggs.
Sabine was dimly aware that Patrick was now standing in the kitchen doorway.
You are a guest in my house, said Joy, speaking as if she were fighting to control her breath. And while you are a guest, the least I expect is for you not to go rummaging around in things that don't concern you.
They're just bloody pictures. A few stinking pictures. Apart from the ones with my mummy, and they're not even very nice.
Sabine began to cry.
God, I can't believe you're making this into such a big deal. I was bored, okay? I was bored and fed up, and I wanted to see what my mum looked like when she was my age. If I'd known you were going to throw a bloody wobbly about it, I wouldn't have gone anywhere near your stupid pictures. I hate you. I hate you. And I wish I was at home.
The crying dissolved into deep, ragged sobs. Sabine sank down at the table and buried her face in her crossed arms. Annie, who had been standing helplessly, closed the front door and walked over to the table. She laid a hand on Sabine's shoulder. Look, she said. Mrs. Ballantyne, I'm sure Sabine didn't mean any harm. Patrick walked silently into the middle of the room. Is everything okay here? He said. You go on up, Patrick. Everything's fine. We've got guests. They're wondering what's going on. I know, love. Go on up, Annie said. There'll be no more noise. Joy shook her head slightly, as if she had forgotten the presence of the other woman. She glanced up and saw Patrick, and looked suddenly abashed at her own outpouring of emotion.
I'm so sorry, Annie. Patrick, she said eventually. It's not like me to lose my temper.
Patrick looked at Joy and Sabine warily.
Really? I'm so, so sorry.
I'll just be upstairs if you need me, he said to his wife, and walked out.
There was a brief silence, broken only by Sabine's shuddering and sniffing. Joy put both hands to her cheeks, as if feeling their temperature, then moved stiffly towards the door.
Annie, I'm so sorry. Please accept my apologies. Yes. Well, I think I had better get back to the house.
Sabine?
I'll see you later.
Sabine refused to look up.
I'm sorry, said Joy, opening the door.
You're all right, Mrs. Ballantyne, said Annie. It's no problem at all. I'll let Sabine finish her tea, and she'll be back with you later.
Joy sat on the edge of her husband's bed. He lay propped up against a bank of white pillows, gazing across the room at the fire, which Mrs. H. had stoked up before she left. It was dark outside, and the only light in the room came from a bedside lamp, and the flames which flickered in the reflections of the mahogany bedposts, and in the brass handles of the chest of drawers under the window.
"Oh, Edward, I've done an awful thing," she said.
Edward's eyes swiveled rheumily across to Joy's face.
"I completely lost my temper with Sabine, in front of Annie and Patrick. I don't know what came over me."
She wiped at her eyes with one hand, the other clutching a handkerchief she had pulled out of her drawer on her return home. It was unlike Joy to cry. She wasn't even sure when she had last done so. But she had been haunted by the thin adolescent figure who had burst into childish tears in front of her, and haunted more by her own violent feelings towards her.
"She got into the study, you see."
Joy took a deep breath and took Edward's hand. It was bony and dry. Touching it, she could remember when it had been broad and spade-fingered, tanned from working outside.
She had been rooting through the old Hong Kong pictures, and there was something about seeing them again. Oh, Edward, I just completely lost my temper.
Edward kept his eyes steady on her face. She thought she could feel the faintest of answering squeezes.
she's only a child, isn't she? She doesn't understand. Why shouldn't she look through the photographs? She knows little enough about her family, God knows. Oh, Edward, I feel like such an old fool. I wish I could take it all back.
Joy began meditatively folding the handkerchief. She knew what she had to do, but she wasn't sure how to do it. It was unlike her to turn to Edward for advice, but he seemed to be having a better day, and there wasn't anyone else who could begin to understand. You were always better with people, much better than I was. What can I do to make it up to her? Joy gazed at her husband and shifted her weight so that she could bend better to hear him speak. Edward's eyes moved away from hers, as if he were deep in thought. After a while, he shifted his face towards her. Joy stooped lower. She knew he had trouble speaking at the moment. When his voice emerged, it was hoarse and crackly, like rice paper.
"Are we having sausages tonight?" he said.
Chapter 5. The one advantage to living in a house mathematically bisected by rules and regulations was that it made it easier to sneak around. Sabine had timed her return to Kilcarrion for 8:15, when she knew her grandmother would be having supper in the dining room. Even when her grandfather had his upstairs in his room, Joy ate there, at a carefully set table, as if solitarily upholding some grand tradition. And Sabine had worked out a back route, which didn't involve her passing the dining room. If she came through the back door and walked silently along the corridor that led to the boot room, she could come up the back stairs and out onto the main landing without her grandmother even knowing she was there. Because there was no way she was speaking to her again. The next time she saw her, it would be to say goodbye. She would wait until her grandmother had gone to bed, then tiptoe silently into the living room and call her mother to tell her she was coming home. Her grandmother didn't have a phone in her room, so she wouldn't hear a thing. And her grandfather never heard anything anyway. As long as the dogs didn't get excited and start barking, she would have it all planned and ready before her grandmother could do anything about it. The little knot of tension that Sabine had felt for the remainder of her stay at Annie's had not dissipated as she made her plans. But she didn't mind. She was almost grateful. Her sense of fury and injustice gave her the determination to move on. Yes, she would miss Tom and Annie and Mrs. H., and it was a shame that she had just started to enjoy herself a bit. But there was no way she was staying one more day with that woman. No way. At one point after her grandmother had left, when she had been at the snot and shudder stage of crying, she had suggested to Annie that perhaps she could sleep in her spare room, the one next door to Annie and Patrick's room, which never got used by guests. Then she wouldn't have to come back to Kilcarrion at all. But Annie had gone funny again and said no, no one was to use that room, and Sabine had decided not to push it. At the moment, she needed all the friends she could get. Sabine pulled out her holdall from under the bed and began to throw in her clothes. It was better this way, she told herself. She and her grandmother just didn't get on. She could understand now why her mother never came back to Ireland. Imagine growing up your whole life with that! Sabine felt a stab of longing for Kate, and comforted herself with the thought that at this time the following evening she would be back in the house in Hackney. That was the important thing. She would deal with the Justin thing later. She moved to the chest of drawers, hauling them open and throwing her clothes into the case chaotically, careless of whether they were likely to crease. She was fed up with doing things the so-called right way. From now on, she would simply do things her way. But as she packed, she found she couldn't think too hard about Justin, or Jeff, or about the good things at Kilcarrion, like riding with Tom this morning, and the way he put his hand on her shoulder,
and told her he'd make a horsewoman of her yet. Or the way he kept leaning across to her when they untacked their horses in the yard, and gave Liam a warning glare when he tried to make rude jokes in front of her. Or Mrs. H and her food, which was loads nicer than she was likely to get at home with just Mum around. Or Bertie, who followed her around now and seemed to adore her in a way Goebbels never had, even though she had raised him herself from a kitten. Or even Annie, weird as she was. Because if she thought too hard about any of these things, Sabine found that she wanted to cry. A lot. She jumped at the soft knock on the door, then froze. Caught in the act, she thought. But then she realized that whatever her grandmother did these days made her feel like that. Sabine stood still and said nothing, but eventually the door opened anyway, slowly and cautiously, making a soft swooshing noise on the blue shag pile. Her grandmother stood before her, bearing a small wooden tray, on which stood a bowl of tomato soup and some of Mrs. H's buttered soda bread. Sabine stared at her for a minute, tense and still, awaiting the next onslaught. But Joy merely looked down at the tray. "I thought you might be hungry," she said. And then, as if having waited for some protest, walked slowly over to the dressing table. If she noticed the half-packed bag, she didn't say anything. She placed the tray gently on the cleared space, then turned round so that she was facing her granddaughter. "It's only canned tomato, I'm afraid. I hope that's all right." Sabine, who stood motionless beside the bed, nodded warily. There was a lengthy silence. Sabine waited for Joy to move, but she didn't seem to want to. Instead, she clasped her hands together a little awkwardly and half lifted them towards Sabine, forcing her face into a bright smile. Then she thrust them deep into the pockets of her padded waistcoat. "Tom tells me you rode very well today. Very tidy," he said. Sabine stared at her. "Yes," he said, "you and the little grey got on terribly well, which is good news, very good news. He said you had soft hands and a very nice seat." Sabine's careful monitoring of her grandmother was briefly diverted by the thought of Tom examining her backside. Was it all riding terminology, or had he been looking at her for other reasons? "Anyway, he seemed to think the pair of you would be jumping soon. He's a lovely jumper, that grey. I've seen him out in the field. Brave as a lion, he is. A really generous little soul." She was looking really uncomfortable, Sabine realised. She was now twisting her hands together round an old white handkerchief, and she seemed to find it difficult to meet Sabine's eye. "He'll do a Wexford bank, you know, with no trouble." Sabine felt sad suddenly at the old woman's discomfort. It didn't make her feel better at all. She lifted her head and spoke. "What's that?" "A Wexford bank? Oh, it's the hardest thing. Not an easy jump at all." Joy was speaking too fast now, as if in relief at Sabine's response. "It's a big old earth bank, probably 5 or 6 feet high, with a wide ditch on each side. The horses gallop up to it, then leap onto the top, and the clever ones balance there briefly, as if they were on tippy-toes." Here she brought her hands together, facing down, and moved them side by side, like someone adjusting their weight. "Then they leap off again over the other ditch. But they won't all do it, you see. It requires a lot of bravery, and a little wisdom. And some always choose to take the easy route." "By the gate?" "Yes," said her grandmother, looking at her very seriously. "Some will always take the gate." The two stood in silence for a moment. Then Joy moved slowly away from the tray and back towards the door. When she got there, she turned round. She looked very old and rather sad. "You know, I thought it would probably be a good idea if I sorted out that study. I was wondering if you might give me a hand. Perhaps I could even tell you a few bits about where your mother grew up. That's if you wouldn't be bored. There was a long silence, and Sabine stared at her hands. She wasn't quite sure what to do with them.
You know, I'd really be terribly grateful.
Sabine gazed at her, and then at the tray. She glanced over at the holdall on the floor, where her socks hung over the edge like rude blue tongues.
All right, she said.
Chapter 6 SS Destiny, Indian Ocean, 1954. Mrs. Lipscomb, from under her wide blue hat, was telling them how she had given birth. Again. The midwife had given her brandy, which she had thrown up, not being a drinker. Not then, anyway, she laughed dryly. And the silly woman had bent over, trying to wipe it off her shoes. That, unfortunately, was the point at which Georgina Lipscomb had pulled herself upright and, with a roar, had grabbed whatever came to hand and borne down. Propelled by an almighty final push, the bloodied Rosalind had shot halfway across the room to be caught like a rugby ball by the vigilant maid who had been waiting nearby.
"Pulled a great handful of that woman's hair out, I did," Mrs. Lipscomb said with some pride. "They said I wouldn't let go of it for the best part of an hour. All poking through my fingers it was. She was furious!"
Joy and Stella, seated beside her on sun loungers, exchanged the minutest of grimaces. Georgina Lipscomb's stories were a useful source of entertainment, but once she'd had a couple of gin and tonics, they did tend to get rather gory.
"Was she all right?" said Joy politely.
"Rosalind? Oh, she was fine. Weren't you, darling?"
Rosalind Lipscomb sat on the edge of the swimming pool, her plump, childish legs half submerged in the cool blue water. As her mother spoke, she lifted her head and stared briefly at the three women, before returning to examine her pale feet. Hard as it was to discern any expression, Joy thought that she too had probably heard this story many times before.
"I don't know why she doesn't swim. It's so hot, Rosie, darling. Why don't you have a swim? You'll burn terribly sitting there."
Rosalind looked up at her mother reclining on the sun deck, and then silently withdrew her feet from the water and padded away from the pool and over to the changing rooms. Georgina Lipscomb raised an eyebrow.
"You girls will find out soon enough." "Oh, the pain! I told Johnny that was it. That was absolutely it. I was never going through it again."
She exhaled a thin plume of smoke into the bright air.
"Of course, I had Arthur within the year."
Unlike his sister, Arthur sat by himself in the shallow end, pushing a wooden boat across the waves. Despite the heat, he was the only other occupant of the pool, owing to the previous evening's ship's variety concert, which, if measured in hangovers at least, had been quite a success. The former troop ship SS Destiny had been at sea almost 4 weeks, and its jaded cargo of naval wives travelling to meet their officers, and officers travelling to new postings, had been desperate for something to divert them from the endless journey and the now relentless heat. The days had rolled by, pitching and yawing like the sea, punctuated only by the meals, snippets of gossip, and the slow but definite change in climate as they headed away from the port of Bombay towards Egypt. Joy often wondered how the troops had coped, stuck all the way down below, without even windows in their cabins. She would have liked to ask some of the Muslims in the engine room what it was like down in the noisy, oily, thrumming bowels of the ship. But it had been made clear to her that her interest in such matters was not quite the thing. And desperate for a change from the endless walks around deck,
"Come on, Joy!" Stella would exclaim every morning, shaking Joy from her slumber. 10 times around the deck for firm thighs!"
Games of cards, or, when the weather was rougher, brandy and ginger ale to combat seasickness.
She and the little group to which she and Stella had found themselves curiously conjoined since their time on board had leapt on the opportunity to do something different. There had been a lot of drinks, even more than usual. One of the guests on the captain's table had started things off with a robust version of My Blue Heaven, and then, after a few feeble protestations, it seemed to Joy that her fellow travellers had almost fought each other for the chance to sing, tell jokes, or embark upon some ill-advised public revelation. Stella, fuelled by 3 gin and tonics, had stood and sung Singing in the Rain, making up for her tunelessness by charming everyone with her winsome expression. She had been followed by Peter, the burly sun-kissed Dutchman, who did Something in Diamonds, who had sung something exclamatory in Dutch, then tried, unsuccessfully and rather physically, to persuade Stella to join him in a duet on the piano, clutching at her slim hands as if he could place them on the keyboard himself. Stella's genteel modesty in refusing was much admired on Joy's table, so Joy didn't let slip that the only thing Stella could play was chopsticks. The evening had degenerated after the stewards had brought round a bottle of rather fierce cognac. It degenerated a little further after Peter accepted a bet to down the remaining third in one fiery gasp. It degenerated properly when Mr. Fairweather and his wife, having already silenced listeners with their reedy rendition of I Get a Kick Out of You, had stood, held hands, and attempted the duet from the Pearl Fishers, the painful climax of which had prompted Georgina Lipscomb to snort her drink all over the mauve satin bodice of her dress, and Louis Baxter, one of the travelling officers, to start hurling bread rolls, so that the captain had to intervene and appeal good-naturedly for calm. He got it, eventually, but Mrs. Fairweather, pink with hurt, hadn't spoken to any of them for the rest of the evening. Even when she was grabbed and rigid-faced, forced between 2 stewards into a chaotic conga line that lurched its way around a circuit of the top deck. It was at that point that Joy had noticed Stella was missing again.
"You know, it's taken me all day just to be able to see straight again," said Georgina, sliding her sunglasses back up her nose. "I don't know how you girls manage to look so hale and hearty. Not being woken up at the crack of dawn by children, I suppose." "Oh, I look a wreck," said Stella agreeably, smoothing her unruffled hair.
You should do, thought Joy, remembering how Stella had crept back into the cabin a good hour after dawn had broken. Now, as they lay on deck in their new 2-piece costumes, Joy tried not to think too hard about Stella's increasingly frequent absences. She was pretty sure she loved Dick, the dashing pilot whom she had married shortly after Joy's own wedding.
"I wouldn't be sailing halfway across the world to meet him otherwise, would I?"
Stella responded tartly to her tentative inquiries. But there was something about her increasingly flirtatious manner with the other officers, and especially her friendship with Peter, that left Joy with an unbalanced feeling that could not be ascribed wholly to her lack of sea legs. She had unwisely confided her concerns to Georgina Lipscomb, with whom they shared a cabin, one night after her children had gone to sleep, and Georgina had raised an eyebrow and suggested that, if anything, Joy was being naive.
"Happens on every ship, darling," she had said, lighting up one of her omnipresent cigarettes. "Difficult for some girls to keep the faith when there are lots of lovely officers around. I'd say it was boredom, mostly. What else is there to do on board?"
Georgina's jaded speech and the casual way in which she puffed out the last sentence made Joy wonder if she really was being naive. She hadn't seen Georgina, who was married to a naval engineer, being special friends with anyone. But then there was always a good 2 hours between when she asked Joy and Stella to leave the cabin so she could read the children a story, and the time when she emerged for dinner. And Joy knew for a fact
that it was always the friendly Goanese steward who bathed and read to the two children, because he had told her so. Perhaps Georgina, too, was occasionally diverted by the lovely officers. Perhaps Joy was the only woman who wasn't. She thought of Louis Baxter, who had been terribly attentive the previous evening, making a point of seating himself next to her. But Louis's presence, agreeable as it was, struck Joy with no such uncertainties. No one on board could possibly compare with Edward. As she often did, Joy thought back almost 6 months to the last time she had seen her husband, or her husband of 2 whole days, as he had been then. They had married in Hong Kong on his 48-hour pass, with just close family in attendance, much to her mother's disappointment, and a wedding breakfast of coronation chicken and shablis, specially shipped over by one of her father's colleagues, who knew a good man in wine. Joy had worn a simple, close-fitting white satin dress, cut on the bias. "It'll make you look less lanky," her mother had claimed. And Edward had worn a smile that lasted almost the entire 48 hours. Stella had outshone her in a midnight blue dress with a plunging neckline and feathered hat that caused all the assembled ladies to tut and mutter at each other through the sides of their lipsticked mouths. Her aunt Marcel, who had travelled over specially from Australia, had trodden on her train, then collapsed in an elaborate heap, complaining of the humidity. Her father had drunk too much and cried, and tipped the French chef in the Peninsula Hotel so generously that her mother had been unable to speak for the last hour of the reception. But Joy didn't care. She was hardly aware of the trappings. She just kept clutching Edward's broad, freckled hand, like someone clinging to a life raft, unable to believe that, after almost a year of silent doubt, largely prompted by her mother's voiced ones, Edward had returned to marry her. It was not that Alice didn't want her to be happy, she had since decided. She was not a malicious woman. She just believed, like an anthropologist studying some strange tribe, that any contact closer than arm's length was bound to end in trouble. "On your wedding night," she had said gravely one evening, as they carefully packed Joy's trousseau into tissue paper, "you should try, well, try to look as if you don't mind, like you're enjoying it." Alice gazed down at the shell-coloured silk trimmed with cream lace, as if struggling with her own memories. "They don't like it if you look as though you're not enjoying it," she said finally. And that was the end of Alice's introduction to married life. Joy had sat awkwardly beside her, aware that her mother had attempted to impart some kind of important maternal advice. So little had come her way untainted by implied criticism that she felt it only right to treat it with some sort of reverence. But try as she might, she couldn't relate her mother's experience to her own with Edward. Her mother flinched visibly when her father, usually drunk, tried sloppily to embrace her. She swatted at his roaming hands like someone who had accidentally sat on a red ant's nest. Joy spent almost all her waking hours wishing that Edward would touch her. So when the night had come, it hadn't occurred to her to be frightened. She was simply, by then, desperate to traverse the invisible divide between those women who knew and those, like herself, who didn't. And fueled by a lengthy absence, where she had had little to do but fill that vacuum of knowledge with her own smudged and inaccurate dreams, she had embraced him almost as hungrily as he had her. It wasn't perfect, of course. She wasn't sure what perfect was even meant to be. But Joy simply relished the closeness of him, let herself be consumed by the simple pleasure of having his skin next to hers. Strong, sinewy, male skin,
its scent and textures such a welcome departure from the primped and powdered femininity that had guided her life until then. She liked the strangeness of him, the strength of their combined bodies, the way his size meant she didn't feel too big, the way his desire for her didn't make her feel like she was doing anything wrong. And the following day, joyous and unself-conscious in her newly awakened state, she had met her mother's questioning gaze with a broad, reassuring smile. But Alice, instead of looking relieved as Joy had intended, had winced and then bustled off, pretending she had something to see to in the kitchen. Joy had etched almost every detail of that night into her memory, to be replayed on the endless humid nights she spent alone, back in the child's bed of her youth. It was just as well that she could, as it was to be 5 months and 14 days before she was to see him again, when she would arrive at Tilbury after her 6-week voyage on the SS Destiny. Stella was also meeting Dick, and both sets of parents had been reassured.